Support for WDTD's morning show comes from Andrea's, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, offering the finest assortment of Easter candy from Fannie Mae, Russell Stover, and more. Treat your family to the best. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm tremendously excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show because we're going to be talking about a topic that I know is intensely personal and pertinent to many of you. I know what it is for me. The book in hand is called Body of Truth: How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. I assure you it is by complete coincidence that I'm doing this interview, even though I happen to be right in the middle of a weight loss regimen prompted by a visit to the doctor. So I don't want our morning show listeners to think that I'm selecting morning show interviews and interesting topics on the basis of my own life. But it just so happens that that this book could not be more timely for me, but much more important for all kinds of listeners joining us today. It is very important that we have this conversation about what it is that makes us, in a sense, so obsessive about weight, about the food we eat, and are there ways in which this obsession, in fact, proves to be counterproductive to those goals that we all have of living long, healthy, happy lives? It is Harriet Brown's persuasive contention that, in fact, we are obsessing to a level that is actually doing much more harm than good in our lives. You may know the name Harriet Brown from a previous book she wrote called Brave Girl Eating, A Family's Struggle with Anorexia, one of the most highly regarded books on that particular topic. And she is an associate professor of magazine journalism at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. This book is published by Da Capo Press, part of their lifelong book series, again called Body of Truth. Harriet Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder if we could start on a personal note for you as well, since I revealed the fact that this is also a very personal topic for me. I know that it is for you on a couple of different levels. Explain to our listeners why this is more than just a professional interest of yours.
Well, like most women in America, I grew up, you know, feeling all of the body pressure and body shame and going through the whole cycle of dieting and losing weight and then inevitably regaining it and then, you know, feeling terrible about myself. I mean, I don't think I know a single woman in America who hasn't been through this, although I hope there are some out there. And I know that there are a lot of men out there who feel it too. So, you know, from that standpoint, I mean, I went on my first diet with my mother when I was 15 years old. And we went to Weight Watchers together. We each lost 20 pounds, and she went on to become a Weight Watchers lecturer, in fact. But, you know, she struggled with her weight her entire life. And, you know, so did I for a long time. So that kind of set the scene. And then my oldest daughter, you know, you mentioned the previous book I had written, which was about my oldest daughter's struggle with anorexia and our struggle to help her recover from it. And that really shifted the way I saw things because I had, you know, been deeply steeped in this notion that, you know, thin is good, fat is bad, that, you know, you need to eat as restrictively as possible to stay healthy, to stay thin. And I saw all that taken to an incredible extreme by the illness that my daughter had. And not only that, I saw how people responded to her. And that was, I think, what really opened my eyes because, I mean, anorexia is a disease, and so, you know, your responses to it are sort of understandable. When you're in the throes of it, you can't help but feel that fat is terrifying and you can't eat. You know, you have a compulsion not to eat. But all around my daughter, how other people reacted to her. I mean, at her sickest, when she was quite gaunt, you know, looking obviously ill. I mean, looking at her, you would have thought maybe she was struggling with cancer. You know, you wouldn't have known, but you definitely would have known something was wrong. People would literally walk up to her in the street, women almost always, and say things to her like, "You have the most amazing figure. You know, what do you do? How do you stay so thin?" Comments like that.
We were like, it was something to emulate.
Oh, absolutely. And like, please tell me your secret so I too can look gaunt, emaciated, with haunted eyes. You know, that's that's what I think is beautiful. And the way even friends and acquaintances sort of talked about, like, they would, on the one hand, you know, "Oh, we're so sorry, you know, is there anything we can do?" But on the other hand, they would then segue immediately into trashing their own bodies, what we call fat talking. You know, so we'd go from, "Gee, I know your daughter is at risk of dying from this horrible disease," to, "God, you know, I really need to lose 10 pounds. Look at my thighs, they're so horrible." You know, and I just sort of, parenting her put me enough outside of the loop that I was able to see it for what it was, this unbelievably damaging cycle that we're all trapped in. So that started me kind of looking at it. I thought, okay, I really want to understand, what does the research tell us? Is it, I mean, obviously it's not good to be so thin that you're at risk of death, but is it better to be thin than fat? You know, what does it all mean? And that began several years of a deep dive into the science of it, which, you know, gave me some surprising. I did not find what I expected to find there, and so that has also been part of my opening my eyes on the subject.
Right. I find this a fascinating topic, and even more fascinating given the way that you are exploring it, because on the one hand, your book is loaded with science and calling into question sloppy science, or maybe science with an agenda. That is, people who have conducted various studies to present certain findings that almost seem preordained, with a preordained message about you need to eat less, or you need to eat this supplement, or you need to join this exercise regimen because it's the only smart thing to do. So there is, on the one hand, that it is a book about a lot of that. And on the other hand, it's also a book about people and their attitudes, about the way they think, the way they feel, which is a little less firmly rooted in the statistical world of science, let's say. But I think you're trying to be equally careful and meticulous in analyzing that and helping us try to understand why we think the way that we do about our bodies.
Yeah, and because I know from personal experience, it's not helpful to just say, "Well, you know, this is all wrong. You should think a different way." I mean, obviously, culture shapes us, and we live in this culture. We're swimming in this sea of media, and, you know, messages are coming at us all the time. There are good reasons why we tend to feel the way we do, and so you can't talk yourself out of a feeling. You have to kind of process it. And so I know what's been helpful for me is to understand, why do I feel the way I do? How are the messages I'm getting adding to that? And then to have some sense of other possibilities. I mean, one of the things I really learned in writing this book is that health is very individual. I mean, if we're talking about the health side of it, a lot of people want to be thin for appearance sake, and that's totally understandable in this culture. But if you're thinking about, I really need to lose weight because of my health, because my doctor says so, whatever, you know, there's not going to be one thing that is going to apply to everybody. What you need to be healthy is going to be different than what I need to be healthy. And that, for me, is one of the biggest takeaways, that not only do we experience the world differently, but our bodies function differently. I mean, I'll give you a good example. I have a friend who's exactly the same height as me, and about the same age. And she's very active, very physically fit, totally not a dieter, just very physically active, eats well. She probably weighs 50 pounds less than me. And she feels great at her weight, and I feel great at my weight, and I have weighed as little as she did, which is not like super skinny. It's a very normal sort of weight for the size. I've been that thin, and I felt horrible at that weight. I was sick, I was dehydrated, I was dizzy, I was so consumed by thoughts of eating, I couldn't really concentrate on anything else. So, you know, two people, same height. If you're looking, talking about BMI, which is how we often talk about these things, you would say, well, this person's BMI should be around here. But the truth is, we need very different things in our bodies to feel good.
Hmm. And unfortunately, as you say, we tend to gravitate towards the simplistic when
yeah.
when talking about something like how much should you weigh. We love the straightforward clarity of a chart that
yes.
with a point on it on which we should ideally be, and we don't tend to gravitate towards shades of gray when it comes to matters like this. It's though we find, in a sense, a perverse sort of comfort in the rigidity of something like a chart telling you how much you should weigh.
I think we do, and I think to some extent that comes out of our very American sense that, you know, you can reinvent yourself. You can be whoever you want to be. You can make your body into whatever it is. You know, we have this endless appetite for self-improvement, and I think that's one of the factors that plays into it. And so, yeah, tell me what the goal is, and I'll work hard and pull myself up by my bootstraps and do everything I can to get there. It's much harder to sort of tune into yourself, understand yourself, you know, experience your own body and your own appetites and your own needs and your own health and think, okay, well, I really want to look like Twiggy, but, you know, that's going to be a real challenge for someone of my build or my age or whatever.
We're speaking with Harriet Brown and talking about her book, Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. By the way, briefly, I want you to say a word about the course you created at Syracuse University, where you are professor. You tell us in the introduction that you created a class on body diversity. Just say a quick word about what prompted you to do that and the kinds of things you explore in that course.
Sure. Well, our students are required to take certain courses in diversity, but I really pitched to the school that, you know, we talk about racial diversity, we talk about ethnic diversity, we talk about gender. Let's talk about body diversity, too. And they were open to that. And so one of the very first things I do in the class is explain to the students that we're going to use the word fat. We're not going to say overweight. We're not going to say obese, because overweight suggests there's a right weight to be. Obese literally means someone who eats too much, and it's become a very clinical word. So we're going to use the word fat in a very, you know, non-judgmental way, and that's the beginning of their struggle in the class. You know, I could see, like, the word, they can't hardly get it out of their mouths, you know, at the beginning, and by the end, they're using it very naturally, which is great. But we look at things like how much stigma there is in this culture against people who are fat. And you don't even have to be very fat to be the victim of that. Like, a couple pounds can really shift the balance. And, you know, we look at how people are represented in the media. And they're all studying to be media professionals, so I'm hoping that they go off into the world and do a better job than we're getting now.
Hmm. I was reminded as I read about that of, for instance, a moment a few years ago when Rosie O'Donnell, at the time when she had her own very popular daytime talk show, mm-hmm. at some point, some company, I don't remember if it was Barbie or what it was, but a Rosie O'Donnell doll was made, and a great attention was given to the fact that this doll was a little bit stocky.
Mm-hmm.
To reflect what was what generally speaking is the way her body sort of looks, as opposed to the pencil thin Barbie dolls that otherwise we see on toy store shelves. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, I think a lot of people lauded this as a really nice gesture, and it, you know, maybe taught certain girls an important lesson. And on the other hand, just by sort of throwing a party over the fact that this doll is a little bit stocky looking, it also sort of, in a sense, almost made too much of it, or in a sense made it not a normal thing to have that kind of, it like made it sort of underscored the extraordinary nature of mm-hmm. of somebody having a body like that, although it was worth discussing at length. I should think it's really a tricky thing if we don't want people to be over obsessive about how much they weigh. In a sense, how do we celebrate diversity without, in a sense, kind of stepping over that line where it becomes almost something too grandiose and something we just are obsessing about just in a different way. Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it's a really, really smart question because, it's a process is really the answer. So right now, you know, in the media, TV, you know, advertising, let's talk about TV maybe. There's very few characters who are larger than a size 2 or 4 represented, and they're typically represented in very stereotypical ways. So, like, there's the Melissa McCarthy, you know, the fat, vulgar, very non-sexual friend. You know, there's the Rebel Wilson, you know, ha-ha, I'm funny and I'm going to make fun of my own fat before you can. But they're never the protagonist, you know, so I don't like those stereotypes, but I consider them a step in the process, you know, and that I think we are moving toward, like, look at Mindy Kaling, not that you would really call her fat in any way, but she's, like, fat for Hollywood, as Jennifer Lawrence once said. So, you know, I think it takes time to sort of begin to see more representation, and there's going to be these sort of problematic, you know, episodes, like when Elle magazine they did a series of 4 covers for one of their issues, and I don't remember who the other 3 actresses were. They were all very slender Hollywood actresses, and Melissa McCarthy was the 4th. And so the other 3 were all shown full body or mostly full body in beautiful dresses. Melissa McCarthy was shown in a coat that covered her entire body. So, you know, a big uproar, you know, around this, like, well, they put her on the cover, but they won't show her body, you know, and there's a lot you could say about that, but at the end of the day, they put her on the cover, and I think that's a good thing. So I think, like all social changes, it's slow and it's a process, and we just have to keep working toward it.
Your book is loaded with very careful analysis of much of the research that has been done, much of which has been either sloppily done or misinterpreted or misapplied. And this in and of itself is sort of a fascinating matter, and it's one reason why you take a couple pages to talk about research itself and how careful one has to be in interpreting what has been done in research and so on. In particular, you talk at great length in the book about the difference between correlation and causation.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably something a lot of our listeners have heard of before, and the problems we get into when we are vague with those two terms. Talk specifically about why it is really important to keep this in mind when we are talking about some of the research that has been done about, for instance, weight and food.
Right. It is, the reality is in science, it's especially in medical science, it's very hard to prove that one thing causes another. I mean, we can barely really sort of know that lung cancer, that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer. I mean, I'm not denying that connection by any means. I'm just saying real cause and effect is very hard to prove because our bodies are complicated and we live in a complex environment and there's a lot of things that sort of affect you. So we tend to talk about correlations like, well, you know, people who smoke have a 9 or 10 times higher chance of developing lung cancer than people who don't smoke. And we also talk about that as risk factors. And in the case of smoking and lung cancer, yes, clear link, and it makes sense. But to take a look at another correlation with lung cancer, just to use it as an example, people with yellow teeth have a much higher association of having lung cancer. So do we think that having yellow teeth causes lung cancer? No. In fact, we can look at it and say, well, people who smoke often have yellower teeth. So, you know, but if you're just looking at correlations, you could look at that and say, you know, having yellow teeth is a huge risk factor for lung cancer. Everyone needs to be using those white strips constantly all the time. And of course, that wouldn't really be addressing what the issue is, but because we would be looking at correlation, we would be confused about that. So the same thing works in studies around weight loss. So for example, you said you're on a weight loss program right now, and if you are in fact losing weight, you might say, wow, you know, my blood pressure's down. It must be because I lost weight, you know. But actually, maybe your blood pressure comes down because you've added some physical activity into your life, or because you've stopped eating so much salt, or because, you know, whatever. The changes that you're making in order to lose weight actually are improving your health. So it's a subtle point in a way, but it's like it's not the weight loss itself, perhaps, that's causing your improvement in health, but the behaviors that you're doing. And so the flip side of that is we all are capable of doing things to improve our health. Like, I have come away from this research with, I've always been a physically active person, but now I'm like a really dedicated to physical activity because I see how greatly, and it doesn't, we're not talking about 5 hours in the gym on the elliptical. We're talking about taking a brisk walk every day, or, you know, going dancing, or whatever physical activity you love. That will have significant health improvements no matter where you are on the spectrum, whether you're fat, thin, healthy, unhealthy. So that is a good example of how, you know, we conflate fat and unhealthy and thin and healthy, and we miss some of the other things that are actually probably much bigger factors. Is that a good answer?
Absolutely. No, I understand exactly what you're saying. In the first main chapter of the book, you lay out four big fat lies about weight and health, in which we tend to do exactly this. We tend to, in a sense, pin our hopes on weight, and also you know, chart our own health, good health or bad health, according to how much we weigh. I mean, beyond, as you said, the whole matter of whether or not we think we look better when we are heavy or not so heavy, and so on. But these are fascinating, these lies. One of them was especially surprising to me. The first one, when you say this is the myth or the lie: Americans are getting fatter and fatter. At this rate, nearly half of us will be obese by the year 2030. Mm-hmm. I think we see that sort of information or statement bandied about all the time, that it's almost unthinkable to imagine it not to be true. But you tell us, in fact, it really isn't true.
It really isn't true. There was a documented average weight gain in this country, and it happened between 1980 and 2000. And so you can frame it in a number of ways. Really what happened is most people in this country got a little heavier, and a small number of people got a lot heavier. So there was some kind of increase in, like, extreme obesity, and everyone else kind of got maybe 18 pounds heavier on average, although, you know, it's not really an averaging kind of thing. And that really stopped around 2000. We don't know exactly why, and we have some good ideas of a lot of the causes, but it's not continuing to go up, right? So I find it fascinating and disturbing that the rhetoric is so much about, oh my God, this is an emergency, we have to do something about this right now, you know. We're not getting fatter. By the way, we also got taller during that time period, although that's, you know, whether that's relevant or not, we don't really know either. But I think that a lot of the way we talk about this, the conversation, has come to rely on this sense of panic, you know, health panic and a moral panic, like, oh my God, what's wrong with all of us? We're so undisciplined, we're so lazy, we're so, you know, self-indulgent, whatever it is. And, you know, I don't think that's a helpful way to frame it. It certainly isn't working for us. I think we're more obsessed and we're fatter than we have ever been before, or, you know, we're not continuing to get fatter, but here we are, and so, you know, I think we need to maybe reframe it in a different way.
Absolutely.
Another lie like that is that, you know, our children will be the first generation to live shorter lives than us. That I also, I don't know if you, if that caught your attention too in the book, but that's
Absolutely.
Another thing you hear bandied about a lot, and it's a lie because the reality is mortality, like your chance of dying early, you know, we like to think that, well, if you're a, quote, normal weight, thinner, you're going to live longer, but the truth is people who live the longest, their weight falls in the overweight to mildly obese category. So no, it's not true that if more people are overweight, they're going to live shorter lives.
One thing that was interesting about that point in the book is that you recount the studies done by an epidemiologist by the name of Catherine Flegel,
mm-hmm.
and who was one of the first to do a serious study which called into question this assumption everybody was making that we're dying younger if we're overweight. And you recount how vigorously she was attacked for her work. I mean, vehemently criticized for her work as a scientist, and also castigated for daring to sort of spread this message, which other people felt was just like an invitation for people to go ahead and overeat or whatever. And it was really interesting to follow that because it probably helps us understand how a given scientist wanting to study this, in a sense, risks their very reputation if they're not going to go along with the flow, with the prevailing wisdom when it comes to some of these very important matters and questions.
That's right, and that does us all a disservice, a huge one. And, you know, I've talked with Catherine many times, and I know that she didn't set out with an agenda. She was genuinely curious. You know, she's an epidemiologist. Let's look at this. And there are other epidemiologists have studied this and found the same thing. Now, there are studies that have found a different thing, and they sort of come from the other group of scientists, let's say, who seem to get very upset about this. But there are, you know, in my opinion, methodological problems with their research that, you know, they set out with an agenda, they skewed the data in a certain way, and they came out with a slightly different finding, and that's always happening in science, and that's why it's important to understand how research is done and the limitations of any given study, you know.
Mm. I was also very much on a personal level interested in the third of these myths, being fat causes heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and other serious illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
It was a visit to my doctor and the information about my blood sugar levels and the fact that I was verging on being diabetic that set me on the weight loss regimen that I am on right now.
Mm-hmm.
But this portion of the book calls some of those assumptions into question. And this is probably, in some respects, maybe the most controversial moment in your book, in which you are really swimming against the prevailing presumption that obesity is very much linked with those kind of serious health maladies. What are a lot of people missing here that you are trying to tell us?
Well, one thing they're missing is the difference between correlation and causation, right? So there's a growing body of research that looks at, for example, the strongest link between higher weights and disease is with type 2 diabetes. That's where the risk factors are highest and the correlations are strongest. But what we, as a number of scientists are now starting to say, we don't know, does being obese cause type 2 diabetes, or is an early symptom of type 2 diabetes weight gain? And it matters because how we treat it would matter very much. And so, you know, you went to your doctor and he said or she said your blood glucose levels are too high, bring them down by weight loss. But to lose that weight, you're probably eating in a fairly different way. You probably cut out carbs or you've cut down on eating carbs and
right.
sugars and things like that. Weight loss is a byproduct of that, maybe. For some people it would be, but that's what you're doing that's going to bring your blood glucose down, and maybe you added some physical activity, too, to help your body, you know, metabolize. It's not the weight itself. You know, and one of the really interesting examples of that is bariatric surgery, which, you know, people are now talking about as well, it cures type 2 diabetes and it cures all kinds of things. But here's the interesting thing. So if you've got type 2 diabetes and you have bariatric surgery, your blood sugar is very likely to normalize within like 2 weeks of having the surgery. And you haven't lost weight yet. You know, you've lost a couple pounds maybe. You haven't lost 100 pounds in 2 weeks. Why does your blood sugar normalize then? It's because you're only eating like 500 calories a day. You know, it's not the weight, it's the behavior. And so it just frustrates me. I mean, we know that people who go on super low-calorie diets, and I'm not saying they're good for you at all, but they too experience the same thing. You know, their type 2 diabetes will seem to normalize after a while. The trouble is we can't stay on 500 calories a day, most of us, for the rest of our lives, you know, nor should we.
Hmm. And I think what you're saying here is because we have all of these societal prejudices towards thinness against fatness, that then it makes perfect sense then, that then when it starts coming down to, you know, kind of a complicated or tricky question, such as how can I avoid becoming diabetic? Mm-hmm. We have in the back of our mind this big issue of weight that's already there for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with health or well-being. But it's little wonder then that's what we gravitate towards as sort of the magic pill or the magic lever we pull, when in fact, in so many cases, you're suggesting we have to look beyond issues of weight, that is being way too simplistic, and sometimes we're missing the most important matter.
Yes, and that emphasis, that's very well put, Greg, and that emphasis on weight, so you might say, well, so what if it's accomplishing the goal? But that emphasis, and we could talk for another hour about this, is very damaging to us psychologically as well as physically. It causes all kinds of, you know, negative health behaviors. It torments us. It's not a good thing for us on many, many levels. So why not just talk about, you know, the real issues, the health, not the sort of proxy for health, which has become weight.
Hmm. I think another very important part of your book is when you explore this whole notion of our obsession with dieting and our relationship to food. And here you are really exploring some fascinating matters of our relationship to food and how we live in a time and place when most of us at least have unfettered access to just an amazing array of food. Mm-hmm. And yet we approach food with such fear, with such trepidation, and in a way that I think you say at one point in the book that our ancestors would find truly bewildering. I mean, they would be bewildered by all the food options that surround us, and at the same time would probably be completely bewildered by how much we obsess about it and how troubled we are. That's a tricky thing to sort of unravel, but I think it's a very important point for us to explore.
Yes, and, you know, I hear my students talk about food all the time in ways that are very disturbing, and a number of them have said to me, like, I don't know how to eat like a normal person. Like, what does that even mean, eat like a normal person? And I think that's a key point because, you know, we kind of bounce between like, oh, you know, you need to restrict, you need to cut out this or that. And I'm not talking about people with specific health issues like yours, where you might have a good reason for wanting to, you know, minimize the carbohydrates you eat, say. I'm talking about healthy 20-year-olds, you know, and 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds. And so, you know, we don't know how to eat normally, they say. And I think it's because we've been separated from our own, like, appetites. Like, we don't trust ourselves anymore to know, like, this is what I eat, this makes me feel good, this makes me feel not so good, so maybe I'm not going to eat so much of this. Because we're always responding to someone else's idea of what we should be eating. Oh, the diet plan. That's why we love the diet plan. It's going to tell me exactly what to do. I don't have to make any choices. I just follow the plan, you know. And or then we're, like, going in the other direction and sort of susceptible to all the food marketing and, you know, I'm just going to pig out, we say, you know, or be bad or whatever words we put to it. And I'm going to eat long past the point where I'm hungry or even want this. So I really feel the key is to sort of get back to our primal relationship with food. You know, if you're feeding a baby and the baby is full, the baby will turn her head. She's not going to eat anymore, you know, unless you, like, try to force her. And we all have that ability. We just have gotten really far away from it.
I thought one really important, interesting part of the book came in the chapter called Good Food, Bad Food. When you kind of talk about our lack of nuance in thinking about food. And one of the ways you do that is by charting the way in which our scientific understanding of food has maybe gained nuance over the years, and yet the way in which we sort of feel about food or think about food and talk about food lacks that kind of nuance. I wonder if you could talk us through this portion in which you're talking about somebody of the name of Ansel Keys. I'd never heard of him before, but evidently he's a really important figure in this whole movement, and sort of where we are now compared to when he first released some of his own findings.
Well, Ansel Keys was a fascinating figure, and he was at the University of Minnesota for a long time, and he was interested in looking at, you know, metabolism and both ends of the spectrum. So he did some fascinating studies about starvation, which was, you know, at the end of World War II when you know, most of the populations of Europe had been malnourished for years in one way or another. And then he kind of looked at the other end, too. What happens if you take people and force them to gain weight? You know, what happens to their bodies, to their psyches, and all of that? So, and he sort of, his main finding was that we kind of make sense to us. We have set points in a way. We have, you know, places where our bodies naturally want to be in terms of weight and how we eat and what we eat, and you can override those. You can suppress your weight, or you can, you know, increase your weight, but it's hard to do. And I think that his work sort of underlays that idea of what is sometimes called competent eating or intuitive eating or, you know, mindful eating, that it's your body actually knows what it's doing, and it knows how to get there, and it understands what you need to function well physically and psychologically.
The book is a fascinating exploration of this tremendously important question about how we can better understand food and our own weight, our own bodies, and it's called Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It, published by DaCapo. Harriet Brown, I thank you so much for writing such a thought-provoking book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg, for such an insightful interview.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm very excited to be able to speak for the next few minutes with author Mary Ann Hoberman, who has really generated some interest over a new series of books which she has created. A series called You Read to Me, I'll Read to You, very short Mother Goose tales to read together. And this is designed with very young readers in mind who are just beginning to enjoy the great wonders of reading. And this is a way in which that can be even more of a shared experience. Of course, a lot of people, even with books that are very simply written, achieve some of that back and forth exchange and trading off of the reading. But this is a book which really empowers you to do that in a very, very exciting way. Marianne Hoberman's most recent book includes some wonderful familiar tales with a bit of a modern twist and some delightful illustrations by Michael Emberley. The books are published by Little Brown and Company. And we have with us on the phone for the next few minutes Marianne Hoberman, who recently was given the National Council of Teachers of English Excellence in Poetry Award. She has worked with Literacy Volunteers of America, and since we just had Literacy Awareness Day, this is a very timely conversation indeed. Marianne Hoberman, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much.
I wish I knew a little more about how you got into the wonderful field of children's literature. How did all of this begin for you? Not so much this particular series, but just in general, writing for children.
Right. Well, it happened the way it does for lots of children's authors. When I had children of my own, I'd always wanted to be a writer. I don't remember a time, even before I could read or write, when I didn't know that when I grew up, I was going to be an author. But I didn't know that I was going to write for children. But when I had kids, when I was a very young mother, and I had three children, one right after the other, the way one did in those days back in the 50s, and I would make up little poems and stories for them, and my husband was an artist and was studying architecture at that time. And so I got the idea, as I often do, from the title. Often the titles come to me first. And so the title that popped into my head was All My Shoes Come in Twos. And I got that because we were walking along. I was pushing a carriage with two little kids in it, and I was kicking up the leaves in September or October, and that cadence came into my head, and I knew that little children adore shoes because I'd observed my own. So I wrote some poems about shoes, and I asked my husband, Norm, to draw some pictures, and I sent them off to Little Brown, who's the same publisher that I have now, and it was accepted. So that's how I started, and that's how I got into children's books, and it was a very kind of a miracle. It was wonderful. Things don't usually happen that way, but I was very, very lucky.
I think one phenomenon that we've seen, of course, over the last few years is of celebrities, some of them writers and some of them who have never written anything before,
right,
sort of jumping into the field of children's literature, and certainly with varying results,
mm-hmm,
some doing so very successfully, but others who clearly don't understand that this is actually a lot tougher than it might seem.
Yeah.
They probably make the assumption that just about anybody, if they just take a little...
Yeah. Everybody feels that way. And a lot of times they also, you know, they'll come up and say, "It's the best story. Why don't you write it?" Mm-hmm. I mean, I think all authors sort of get that. Yeah, it probably is a particular skill. I write mostly in rhyme and in verse, and I don't know. Some of, as you say, a couple of those books are really good, but there are other celebrity authors who are, you know, they kind of write one book and it falls by the wayside and they never do another. And I couldn't do what they do, and I couldn't do, for example, there are adult writers. I remember a long time ago, Arthur Miller wrote a children's book, and it wasn't very good. I don't think he ever tried to do that again, but I certainly couldn't write his plays. So I think that there are, you know, different kind of writing skills and different feelings for language.
Well, it's interesting because one realizes that, yes, if you are Celebrity X, that might be a name that means a lot to the mother or dad.
Absolutely,
shopping in the store.
Yeah.
But that's not going to be a name that will mean anything to your typical 4-year-old or 5-year-old.
Right, and you'll read the story, and the proof of the pudding is if the child wants it to be read to him or her again. And so there, we have a new batch of young grandchildren, and it's so funny. The ones that they really decide are their favorites, and it changes. And some of their favorites are not very good from my point of view. So it's not always... But other ones, you know, that I do think are just, for example, we have a 3.5-year-old granddaughter now, and it's very surprising to me. She adores the original A.A. Milne Pooh books, and those have just the little black and white drawings, and they're very simple. My husband and I read them to her again and again. She knows some of the poems by heart. She'll sit there for the whole book, and that surprises us, you know. I never would have thought that such a young child would... it doesn't seem to need colorful illustrations or, you know, or really jazzy kind of story.
Bells and whistles. Let's talk about what you have done in this series. This is now the third book in You Read to Me, I'll Read to You.
Yep.
We have retellings of some familiar nursery rhymes and so on, but in a different sort of format.
Yeah.
Explain to our listeners what these books look like.
Okay. Visualize a page and visualize that there are three columns of type. And on the left-hand side, there is type is in, say, blue. That's one voice. On the right-hand side, the type is in, say, orange. That's the other voice. And then down the middle, in that third column in the middle, the type will be, say, in red. And that will be when you read it together. You read in chorus. And so these are little playlets. They rhyme. They're very rhythmical. They're very repetitive. And the voices go back and forth. And they retell some of the, one of the books I did was the fairy tales. And then this newest one is nursery rhymes. But they're nursery rhymes with a twist, so that they're lots of fun for beginning readers in the first, second, third grade. And it's really important, I think, that the kids know the original nursery rhymes so that they can appreciate the kind of twist and the humor that goes into rewriting them. But somehow this has delighted children. They sort of squabble over who'll be red and who'll be blue. They change the parts. In schools, teachers often use it for choral reading. They'll divide the class into two. For home, it's lots of fun with your beginning reader that the parent takes one part, the child takes the other, and then they switch. And so they can be used in all kinds of ways. And I don't know, I just, I feel it was an idea that kind of descended from heaven. I don't know how I thought it up, but I'm awfully pleased that I did.
Well, and I know a lot of readers are. Do you have the book in front of you?
I do. I have them here.
How would it work if we did about a minute's worth of Jack Be Nimble, you and I?
I would just love to.
Good.
I'd love to read them. Okay.
And I should probably start since I'm Jack.
Okay. You're going to be Jack. And let's tell the audience, since it's radio, that the illustrations by Michael Emberley are magnificent.
They are delightful.
Oh,
you're
they're
right.
Just wonderful. And he turns these characters. So in this one, Jack is an elephant, and there's a little girl named Jane, and she's a little pig about a tenth of the size of Jack. Okay.
And this little candle is right there.
There's a little candle in the middle, and we'll say the title together because that's an orange.
Okay.
And then you'll start.
Gotcha. So, Jack
Be Nimble.
I will not jump, Jane.
Jack, why not?
That candlestick might be quite hot.
But, Jack, the candle is not lit.
I still will not jump over it.
It isn't even very high, but you won't jump it. Tell me why.
I'll jump a wall, I'll jump a box, across a stream, or over rocks. But since it is a silly trick, I will not jump a candlestick.
Just take one jump. I wish you would. A single jump. I think you should.
If you're so sure what I should do, go jump yourself. I dare you to.
The candlestick might be quite hot.
It isn't lit. Have you forgot?
I think it looks a little high.
It's very short. Now, will you try?
All right, I will. I'll jump it now, but only if you show me how.
It isn't hard, as you can see. Just start to run and follow me.
Oh, Jack, you jumped it. You were good. You jumped so high, I knew you could.
You tricked me, Jane. I should have known. But now go do it on your own.
Well, here I go. I'll start way back. I'll run. I'll jump. I made it, Jack.
Jack be nimble. Jane be quick.
Jane be quick.
They both jumped over the candlestick. A
so
wonderful twist. Yes, a wonderful twist on a familiar old favorite. And we have Jack and Jill and Jack Spratt and Little Boy Boo and Little Miss Muffet and so on. And I imagine it gives you great joy to see this played out in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. It's wonderful fun to go into schools, for example, and they've Xeroxed some of the stories, and the children each have a copy, and they'll do it in chorus, and then they'll switch, and they'll do it in chorus with the first group taking the second part, etc. And they've done it for assemblies, and it's just, of course, it's very satisfying.
Well, we're glad that you had that eureka moment and that these terrific books have resulted then. The series You'll Read to Me, I'll Read to You, very short Mother Goose tales to read together, published by Little Brown and Company. Marianne Hoberman, a great pleasure to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, James Schatzman.